now the world can see that the Russian what Russian military did in Bucha while keeping the city under their occupation. But the world has yet to see what they have done in other occupied cities and regions of our country. Geography might be different or various, but cruelty is the same, crimes are the same, and accountability must be inevitable.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky speaking through an interpreter at the United Nations Security Council this morning, laying out evidence to back his claims that Russian forces committed war crimes in Bucha. That's a town near the capital, Kyiv. A mass grave has been discovered there, along with the bodies of civilians, apparently with hands tied around their backs. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, spoke about the images coming out of Bucha.
As we work to independently confirm the events depicted in these images, I would remind this council that based on the currently available information, the United States has assessed that members of Russia's forces have committed war crimes in Ukraine.
She's also calling for Russia to be removed from the UN Human Rights Council, calling its membership a farce. Charles Kupchin is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Well, what impact would removing Russia from the UN Human Rights Council have? The U.S. left it, actually, under Trump. It's back in, but still, what effect would that have?
Well, the United States has suggested removing Russia from the Human Rights Council, also removing Russia from the G20, possibly taking a war crimes case to the International Criminal Court. We're still early on in this conversation. These removals from councils require the consent of other members of the groups. In some cases, we're looking at countries that are sitting on the fence and that have not made a decision to condemn Russia's invasion and to take sides in this conflict. So this is going to be a long haul, but there's no question that the pictures that we've seen coming out of Bucha are shocking, and they will create political pressure here in the United States, in Europe, other countries around the world for taking tougher measures against Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Do you think we're seeing another Srebrenica?
We're seeing images that remind us of Srebrenica, that remind us of the shelling of the outdoor market in Sarajevo. But it's also important to keep in mind that this is not something new. Russia has been committing war crimes for the last month and a half, taking missile strikes against apartment buildings, hitting a theater in Mariupol, in which women and children are taking shelter. These are attacks on civilians. They are illegal according to the laws of armed conflict. And so, yes, there is a building case that Russia is committing war crimes here. Moreover, the invasion of Ukraine itself is illegal. International law under the UN envisages two circumstances in which the use of force is legal. One, when a country has been attacked. Two, when the UN Security Council approves of the act of force, the use of force. Neither has taken place. So on all these fronts, the invasion being illegal, attacks against civilians being illegal, and war crimes, Russia is in a bad spot.
Right. President Biden yesterday called Putin himself a war criminal. So if these war crimes are proven to be true in the International Criminal Court, would Putin himself be on trial?
Well, you know, it's hard to go after sitting heads of state. We would also need to find evidence that the crimes that are being committed, for example, in Bucha, go up the chain of command. That is to say, the Russians may say, if they ever admit that these murders have been taking place, they may say, well, this was a rogue unit, and they're not able to trace responsibility up the chain of command. We see lots of leaders out there. Assad, the leader of Syria, comes to mind, who've committed war crimes, who's in fact used gas, illegal use of gas against his own population. He is still the head of Syria. So even if we all agree that Russia has committed war crimes, that Putin himself is responsible, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to see a war crimes case that goes after the Russian leader.
And we should note that Russia and also the United States and Ukraine, none of these countries are members of the International Criminal Court. Does that matter?
Well, it opens issues of jurisdiction, number one, but also issues of reputational concerns. And I think the United States has to some extent weakened its leverage when it comes to the prosecution of war crimes through the ICC by itself not joining the ICC. And that's been the case in part because there isn't sufficient political support to get the ICC through the necessary hurdles in Congress. And also because I think American military is concerned that the ICC might come back and bring cases against American soldiers. So yes, it does to some extent weaken America's hand that we have not joined the ICC ourselves.
Let's talk about President Zelensky today at the United Nations Security Council, chastising it for not really doing anything, not having no teeth. What could this Security Council do that it's not doing now?
Well, unfortunately, the Security Council is hamstrung in cases like this because the five permanent members have veto power. And so if there were to be some kind of serious UN move to sanction Russia, to condemn Russia, it's not going to happen in the Security Council because the Security Council will exercise a veto. You know, Zelensky has been remarkable. I have to wonder whether he does himself perhaps a little bit of a disservice by asking too much, by asking for a no-fly zone that he's not going to get from NATO, by being rather dismissive of the United Nations. It's a strategy that I think does well for him at home, but he needs to make sure that he is doing more to garner international support rather than to perhaps say things that could cause a certain amount of distancing from the international community.
But maybe he thinks, well, if I ask for the moon, I will get the stars, or I will get something less than a no-fly zone, but I'll still get more arms and more tactical support.
It could well be that kind of tactical play. If it is, it's working. Why? Because when President Biden says, no, we're not going to do a no-fly zone. No, we're not putting U.S. troops on the ground in Ukraine. No, we're not transferring high-end fighter jets to Ukraine. There is a certain blowback here in the United States. Public opinion shows that a reasonable number of Americans feel that Biden is not going to be tough enough. That then does create pressure to do more, and we are doing more. There are lots and lots of anti-tank weapons, of anti-aircraft weapons, increasing sophistication of anti-aircraft weapons flowing into Ukraine. And that, I think, is in part because of pressure from Zelensky, but also in part because of growing outrage stemming from the pictures that we are seeing coming out of Bucha.
Charles Kupchin, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University. Thanks for joining us.
Been my pleasure.
Coming up, we continue our series with the top candidates for L.A. mayor. Today, Councilman Kevin De Leon. That conversation is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now. at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Today, we're going to continue my series of conversations with the five leading candidates to be the next mayor of Los Angeles. With LA City Councilman Kevin De Leon, he represents Eagle Rock, El Sereno, Skid Row. I spoke with him yesterday afternoon. Councilman Kevin De Leon, welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you very much, Madeline. It is indeed an honor and pleasure to be here with you.
Well, great to have you back. All right, so let's begin with homelessness. This is, of course, the biggest challenge that Los Angeles faces. On Friday, the city reached a settlement in a lawsuit that would require opening enough beds over the next 5 years for 60% of the city's unhoused population in each city council district. So all told, that's around 16,000 beds. And this still needs to be approved by the city council. You are a city councilman, and you've said you'll vote for it. So what does that mean exactly? Does that mean building new shelters in every council district? And if so, what does that mean with homeowners who perhaps don't want more shelters in their districts?
Well, Madeline, it's a combination of a few things. One is, let's be very clear, this is a humanitarian crisis unlike anything we've ever experienced before. And for too long, Los Angeles has been on a litigation merry-go-round. So many lawsuits has not really moved the needle greatly. And now we have this lawsuit that I think it's a very good compromise between the city and the plaintiffs that will be overseen by a U.S. federal judge or perhaps a special master to make sure that we actually execute. Now, we have about 41,000 folks who are suffering from homelessness. 28,000 of them actually live on the streets of L.A. The other 13,000 approximately have some type of homeless shelter, whether it be congregate, non-congregate, whether it be tiny homes, room key, home key, which are hotel rooms right now. And our goal is to make sure that we either A, build, B, acquire, that's adaptive reuse, purchase older hotels or commercial properties right now that are empty, and convert that into housing, build more tiny homes. So it's a combination of both long-term permanent and interim homes.
Okay, but that would be in every city council district, right?
That would be in every city council district.
So how do you get around NIMBY concerns? Because it's been quite challenging to build shelters in areas that are not Skid Row.
But listen, we have to exercise leadership, because if you don't, then the issue gets bigger. It doesn't get better. And I have myself been the subject of two recalls in my city council district 14, specifically for building a tiny home village that we just opened up last week in the community neighborhood of Eagle Rock. But you have to exercise leadership. And that's why you need a mayor with a coherent vision and the leadership skills to make sure that we actually accomplish what we need to accomplish to put a roof over the head of so many Angelenos who otherwise they're in the neighborhoods today, but they're living in encampments and tents, whether underpasses, whether it is near the LA River. In other words, they're there already. So why not organize ourselves and put a roof over the head? We have showers, we have bathrooms, where you have washers and dryers, where you have security, where you have three meals a day. That's a lot better than the current status quo of today.
But how does that then not become de facto permanent housing and de facto refugee camps that basically become homeless housing in these districts?
I don't think I would utilize the word refugee camps. Yeah, I think that utilizing that word is not the correct word in this case. We have individuals who have been suffering from homelessness and who have been living in our streets, in their cars, in our alleyways for years, if not decades. Many of them suffering from severe drug addictions, whether it be crystal meth with fentanyl, or severe mental illnesses such as schizophrenia, bipolarness, depression, or PTSD, or a combination thereof. We need to move heaven and earth, because I can tell you this, we move heaven and earth to build football stadiums and basketball arenas in Los Angeles. But somehow, some way, the machine of progress grinds to a screeching halt when it's about putting a roof over our unhoused neighbors. We have no choice, because that's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. And now with this legal settlement, it is the legal thing to do. We have to do it, Madeline, because if we don't, again, let me underscore, this situation doesn't get better. It gets only worse, and especially because of the COVID pandemic. That's why we have more folks living on the streets today.
Mm-hmm. But I guess my question being, how do you then transition them into permanent supportive housing? That has been a very slow process. In the last 5 years, fewer than 1,000 units funded by HHH, which was the measure that Los Angelenos voted in to basically tax themselves to build homeless housing, fewer than 1,000 of those units have been built. You have said in the past that you want to build 25,000 by the year 2025, so in just a few years. So how are you going to clear away all of the legislative red tape? I understand it's a very complicated process involving so many different agencies and an expensive one at around $600,000 a unit. How do you propose to do things differently and create more housing quicker?
Well, let me validate what you just said, because I agree 100%, because the doctrine from the housing department in the city of LA has been, how do we build as many units and take the longest time and spend the most money? And that's simply not sustainable with the sizable unhoused population that we have living on our streets today. Now, the current time it takes to build permanent housing for it to go online is an average of 5 years. And you can't have folks living and suffering in misery for 5 years. But we can't let the perfect get in the way of the good. That's why it's a combination of both interim as well as permanent. And it's just not exclusive to building. You know, we know land costs are very expensive. We know soft costs, as well as hard costs, are out of proportion with regards to the budget that we currently have. But it's about adaptive reuse. It's about acquisition of current properties that already exist. It's about master leasing, which is taking advantage of the tens of thousands of vacancies that we currently have in the city and in the region of Los Angeles. So this is not exclusive to just building. This is about acquiring commercial properties, taking advantage of vacancies that already exist today to move folks quickly off the streets and to put a roof over their head. And there is a percentage, no doubt about it, a cohort that are severely mentally ill that need access to mental health services as well as drug addiction services. And that's what we're expecting the LA County Mental Health Department to really step up and do what it needs to do to engage our unhoused neighbors, to put them on the pathway to recovery, and hopefully to be, you know, productive citizens in the city, in the county, the state, and the country.
Well, therein lies one of the problems, because the settlement that we talked about at the beginning of our conversation would not cover people who are severely mentally ill or who have a severe substance abuse disorder, and the county would be tasked with taking care of them. So is it possible that you see a scenario where those people who are the most vulnerable are left on the streets while these other unhoused people are allowed to find a shelter bed?
I think legally, through a strategic perspective, I think we try to engage and collaborate with LA County to come to a settlement with the plaintiffs. For reasons unbeknownst to us, they've made the decision that they shouldn't be privy to this litigation. I think that folks at the LA County are living in a detached universe that's disconnected to what the reality is in our city streets, because the city streets of Los Angeles are the de facto open air asylum for our LA County Mental Health Department. And it's my hope that the LA County Board of Supervisors in unison will rise to the occasion to make sure that our Angeleno neighbors, friends, loved ones, coworkers, next door neighbors who are suffering severely from mental illnesses have a real opportunity to be on a pathway to recovery.
Is that one reason why you want to create a separate city public health department, separate from the LA County Department of Public Health?
I think it's twofold. One is that I think that we need our own public health department to prepare for the next global pandemic, as well as the variant, because let me underscore, there will be another global pandemic. There will be another variant. We have to be in a position to draw down directly from the federal government as well as the state government resources. The city of Long Beach, as well as Pasadena, they have their own public health department. We cannot allow layers of bureaucracy get in the way of saving lives. And I've seen a lot of very smart people make some very bad decisions that have cost people their lives because of the lack of access to the vaccination or PPE equipment. So we have to be in a better position. We are a global city. We're an international city. We should have our own public health department.
So you think the LA County Public Health Department has not done an adequate job with this pandemic?
I think they could have done a lot better job. I have a lot of respect for Barbara Ferrer. I think she's in a very tough position. But having the greatest, you know, data points and deck is not good enough. It's about execution and making sure the epicenters, ground zero for infections and mortality rates, that those folks are actually the ones getting access to the front of the line to vaccinations. This is the reason why I say this, Madeline. Listen. During COVID-19, we've seen the tale of two cities. In one city, the rich got richer, and the other, the poor actually got poor, and the middle class got smaller. We witnessed frontline workers relegated to the back of the line for life-saving vaccinations and PPE equipment. We've seen and witnessed and experienced essential workers treated like expendable workers. At the height of the pandemic, the district that I represent, one of the neighborhoods, Boyle Heights, was both ground zero for both infections as well as mortality rates. These are essential workers living in very dense
neighborhoods. But how is that the public health department's problem? I mean, why is it their fault?
When it comes to the distribution of PPE equipment as well as life-saving vaccinations, it is their responsibility. And if we create our own public health department, then that means we're responsible.
But they did have their own vaccination sites, or there were vaccination sites all over the city.
But Madeline, I would say it was a little too late. It was way too late in the ballgame. If you look at the time frames, folks were not getting life-saving vaccinations, and the hot spots were communities such as South LA, Pacoima, MacArthur Park, Pico Union, East LA, and Boyle Heights specifically. They got there eventually, but they got there really, really late.
Okay, and you're saying if LA City had its own public health department, that would not have happened.
I think if you have a mayor with the shared values and shared experiences of those who have been devastated, it makes a huge difference.
Okay, let's talk about crime and policing. That is also a big issue of concern here in Los Angeles these days. And crime has gone up in Los Angeles, although it's nowhere near what it was in the 1990s. What would you do about it?
I grew up in a neighborhood that had its fair share of violence, so I know what fear feels like. And I do believe that the most important job of a mayor of a city like Los Angeles is to make sure that every Angeleno just doesn't feel safe, but in fact is safe. But I think that anyone can talk about big, bold ideas about hiring thousands of more police officers. But first and foremost, what we need to do is we need to make sure that we have our own house in order. And that means utilizing the current resources that we have in a much more effective and efficient manner. We're budgeted to hire 300 more police officers to 9,706. We've lost 300 due to attrition or folks just transferring to other smaller departments. They want perhaps a smaller workload. But we can hire 300 more police officers in the LAPD. But we also have to hire mental health specialists, because anytime anyone, whether it's on Wilshire Boulevard, whether it's on Ventura Boulevard, Lancashire, if someone's having a psychotic breakdown, we have a whole squadron of LAPD officers there to deal with that issue. I want to take our LAPD officers off the mental health front lines and put them back on the line of duty to protect and serve, to prevent and solve crimes. So we have to better utilize our resources in a much better fashion so we can reduce our response times to crime incidences that are happening all over the city of Los Angeles.
Mayor Garcetti cut the LAPD's budget by $150 million. Did you support that?
That was before my time, so I wasn't there. I wasn't a part of the council at the time.
Okay, so as a citizen, did you support that?
Well, I think that we can revisualize, if you will, the way we utilize our resources, and we can invest in preventative crime as well and make sure that we disrupt and destroy the school-to-prison pipeline altogether so our kids are not going to what was then CYA, County Jail, San Quentin, Folsom, Vacaville, or Pelican Bay, but give them a pathway to go to a Cal State LA or UCLA or a good community college education. So investing in communities and having safe neighborhoods are not mutually exclusive of each other. They're, in fact, I think, compatible with each other.
So is that a yes or a no?
I think that's a yes.
Okay. You did support cutting $150 million.
But I wasn't there to vote for it.
Right. But if you had been there, you would have voted for it.
If I'd been there, I'd been voted for resources. I don't know necessarily if I would have taken it from the LAPD's budget.
Okay. But there has been this debate over defunding the police. And so I don't think you've ever said that you supported defunding the police.
No, I'm not a supporter of defunding the police. I'm not a supporter of defunding the police. My endorsement was to keep it as is at 9,700. We're budgeted for 9,700. And six, we have approximately 9,400. We can hire 300 more police officers, and we can better utilize our LAPD reserves right now. They get paid $50 a month, and they're post-certified, which means they can carry a weapon. I don't want them putting down orange cones. That's why I say we have to better utilize the current resources that we have today.
Do you think LA County District Attorney George Gascon should keep his job?
Well, I've said this very clearly, that the recall process is something I've never supported. And what happens is that when politicians capitulate, when they get weak-kneed, all of a sudden they don't want to do what they were intending to do, and then the problem gets worse, not better. So if folks want to recall George Gascon, the current district attorney, they can do so during a regular electoral cycle.
But would you support that? Do you think he's doing a good job or not?
No, I don't support the recall.
No, I'm not asking that. I'm just asking if you support him. Do you think he's doing a good job?
I think there's some mixed results. I think that George truly wants to bring about the criminal justice reforms that we need for communities of color, like I said a moment earlier, to disrupt that school-to-prison pipeline that exists. At the same time, I don't think you can throw a wide net, because we have individuals who are career criminals who have inflicted a tremendous amount of pain. I've said very clearly that the crime trends that we have in Los Angeles are not unique. They are national in scope. However, when you are a victim of a crime, or you know a family member who has been a victim of a crime, that's something that's deeply personal. And it's something that's very individualized. You know, there's some things that I would not have done if I were in the shoes of George Gascon.
We have a listener question from Isaiah Burke. He asks, Mayor Garcetti promoted Vision Zero, and that's the plan to eliminate traffic deaths by 2025, but very little has been done. What would you do?
Well, I think there actually has been quite a few deaths, pedestrian deaths, as well as bicyclist, cyclist deaths throughout the city of L.A. This is an issue that is not going to go away. We have to have safer streets for pedestrians as well as bicyclists. And it's interesting that the question is asked, because I actually just did a groundbreaking ceremony with regards to 7th Street, 7th and Figueroa, all the way into Skid Row, San Pedro, where we're going to have dedicated bike lanes, but protective bike lanes. We're having different types of bus stops to get folks off and on the buses easily for those who utilize public transportation. And we're planting, you know, trees, 80 trees to be specific. They're going to grow large, going to provide shade. We're going to fix the sidewalks. You know, we have to execute and make the city of L.A. a much more walkable city that's much more friendly, not just concrete and asphalt. I want green grass to grow underneath the children of our feet. And I want safe streets for both pedestrians as well as bicyclists, and move people, you know, as well as goods throughout the city in a much more efficient manner, where we reduce our carbon footprint and we can breathe clean air into our lungs.
Okay, we are also a music station, and so we're asking the candidates all the same music-related question as our final question.
Oh, my God.
Here you go. So here the question is, what is your favorite guilty pleasure song? What are you singing at the top of your lungs when no one is around?
Oh, my God, a guilty pleasure song? Jeez Louise.
Or a non-guilty pleasure song.
You know, it's not going to be Arcade Fire, because I love Arcade Fire. I love Arcade Fire. I love the Foo Fighters, you know, and it's tragic what happens. I love Los Tigres del Norte, you know, which is a great California band. And my favorite Brian of all time is U2.
Oh, U2. Okay.
I love the beginning phase of U2, you know. Two hearts beat as one, New Year's Day.
New Year's Day it is. LA City Councilman Kevin De Leon, thank you for joining us.
Okay, Madeline, you be well. Take care.
Coming up, TV writer Georgia Pritchett. For years, she was the only woman in the writer's room. Now, she's written a memoir.
When you write it all down and look with a bit more objectivity, I think, you know, you can sort of find a bit of compassion for yourself.
Georgia Pritchett is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. On the outside, Georgia Pritchett's life is a screaming success. She's an Emmy Award-winning TV writer of shows like Veep, Tracy Ullman's show, and most recently, Succession. On the inside, well, that's another story. She suffers from severe anxiety. Writing and humor are a way out. As she details in her new book, My Mess is a Bit of a Life, Adventures in Anxiety. Georgia Pritchett, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. And at the beginning, you start the book, you are literally speechless, literally. I don't use that word lightly, but in this case, you are literally speechless. You can't speak because you're so overwhelmed with anxiety and you're trying to talk to your therapist, but you can't talk. And she tells you to write it all down. And is that basically the genesis of this book?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, as you say, I couldn't speak. I'm, as you may be able to tell, I'm British, which mm-hmm. is shorthand for socially awkward and emotionally repressed. So
my mother's British, so I understand.
Oh, completely. Right. You get it. Yeah. It's tough, yeah. You know, it's tough. We should get like free parking or something to make up for it. It's very difficult being emotionally uninvolved. So, yes, when I kind of found myself in crisis, even though I'm a writer and I love words and my whole world is words, I just couldn't find the words to talk about how I was feeling. And so my therapist suggested I write it down. And I thought, yeah, I'm not going to do that. But eventually, you know, in out of desperation, I did start writing. And yeah, the result is slightly alarmingly no holds barred memoir.
Alarmingly, because you're not used to expressing yourself so publicly.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, as a script writer, I'm used to putting words in other people's mouths, and I've never written anything kind of personal before. So yeah, it's kind of horrifying.
Well, it must be horrifying also doing these interviews for the book too.
Yeah.
You keep getting asked about it over and over.
Yeah, exactly. I've written a whole book about how I can't talk about my feelings, and now people keep asking me to do that. So it's really backfired badly.
Well, let's talk about growing up in Britain and how you grew up. You grew up in a family of writers. Your grandfather is the famous short story writer, V.S. Pritchett. And so it must have been a very verbal household. Were you very verbal inside the house?
I don't think it was particularly. We were all writing. We're much better with the written word. And I think, you know, the good thing is that I feel very lucky that I grew up in a family where writing was considered something approaching a proper job, which I know lots of people don't have that luxury. And that, I think, is the one thing in my whole life that I have not felt confused about, that I knew even before I could write, I knew I wanted to be a writer. So I would be sort of speaking stories into a tape recorder that were pretty much without exception about little birds who'd fallen out of their nest and couldn't find their way home, which is a niche genre that hasn't taken off in the way I'd hoped. But yeah, that was how I started. And then at 10, I got given a typewriter and I wrote a really kind of coruscating biography of my hamster, who, like all my pets, devoted all his time and energy into trying to get away from me. So yeah, that's how it started. And then I just, you know, thank goodness I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I just kept going from there.
And you read a lot about your early experiences in school as generally not being great experiences. You didn't really like school. You called it a hideous shock.
Yes, it was. It is. I mean, yeah, so many people there and noise. And I was very shy. And in fact, after I'd been there only a few weeks, I came home and told my parents that I was going to be on the cover of a book, and they were very excited and proud. And then when we got sent the book, it was a completely unposed photo just of me, how I always looked, looking just tormented with anxiety. And the headline of the book was Learning to Adjust. And yeah, I still haven't done that. I've got to get around to that.
Were you actually literally, again, the poster child for being maladjusted as a child on that cover of that book?
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Exactly.
So how did you get into comedy writing? How did you transition from not enjoying school to becoming a comedy writer?
From my hamster biography to comedy, yes. Well, you know, what was interesting is I knew I wanted to write, and my mother, who's very skilled at pointing out people's faults, noticed that I had an incredibly, apparently very annoying habit of sort of learning huge chunks of sitcoms and sketch shows and stand-up comedy that I loved and reciting them. And so I thought, oh, maybe dialogue is my thing. So I started out writing for kind of stand-ups and sketch shows, and I absolutely love it, and I do it every day, and if I don't, I become grumpy and annoying.
So what is your favorite form of comedy writing? Is it the stand-up monologues, or?
I think it's actually narrative comedy, but I think, you know, when you start out, a kind of good place to start is often with stand-ups or on sketch shows. And I think actually that's a really good place to sort of hone your craft, because you learn so much about characters. You know, you have to kind of inhabit the life of whichever stand-up you're writing for. And so that stands you in good stead when you come to write narrative comedy.
And narrative comedy would be something like being in the writer's room at Veep.
Exactly, yeah, sitcoms. And I, you know, it's so interesting because I grew up watching American sitcoms. I was obsessed with American TV because I think the sort of rhythm of the American language or accent is so well suited to comedy. And the other thing that's so great over there is right from the beginning, you've had Lucille Ball and Mary Tyler Moore and Rhoda and Roseanne and Ellen and all those fantastic women in the leads. And we just hadn't had that in the mm-hmm. UK. So I always found it really thrilling watching American shows where women got to be just as funny as the men. That was, you know, really refreshing for me.
I bet, because you write in your book that when you were working in Britain, you were often the only woman in the writing room.
Yeah, always. Yeah, the first time, I think I'd been doing this for like 25 years before I ever got to sit in another room with a woman. And that was actually in the States working on Veep, where there were two other women. That's literally 300% more women than I was used to. And it was so mind-blowing when I came to work with other women and I realized, gosh, it is incredibly validating and confidence boosting to see yourself kind of reflected back at you, to see people who kind of look like you. And that just made me think, wow, that's what it's like to be a white man every single minute of every day when you walk in any room or turn on the TV, and how difficult must it be for all those people out there who still never see themselves reflected, whether it's on TV or, you know, in positions of authority. It's so incredibly important, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So you worked with Armando Iannucci on his British show before Veep, and
yes.
And then you worked on Veep with him.
Yeah.
And that, I guess that was your big leap into American TV, right? And you had to come over here and work over here. Yeah. At the same time, you had a young family.
Yeah, that was a shock because, you know, the whole point really of being a writer is you get to be at home in your pajamas eating biscuits all day. And so suddenly I had to go away for work. And I remember sitting my children down and saying, you know, I've got to go away for work. And they're like, but you haven't got a job. And I said, no, I have. I have got a job. You know, the thing you see me doing on my computer. And they said, what, playing solitaire? And I was like, not that thing, the other thing you see me doing on my computer. So yes, I'd have to go away for filming when we were writing in the UK and filming in Baltimore. And then after a few seasons of Veep, it got switched to a fully American room and showrunner. And that was all from LA. So what was fantastic was luckily the writer's room was always in summer. So the whole family went out to LA, which was absolutely brilliant.
And so did your family adapt? Did they like it?
They liked it so much that my children still talk in terrible American accents all the time because they just
oh no
want to be American and think it's so great out there. So yeah.
All right, your children you referred to as the speck and the scrap.
Yeah.
And why do you call them the speck and the scrap?
I think, you know, nicknames is like a big thing in my family. And they, even though I'm pretty puny, I somehow gave birth to the most enormous children in the world. So in an ironic way, we called them the speck and the scrap because they were just virtually my size at birth, just massive.
And your partner is the moose. So
I guess
she's not tiny.
I don't really know where that came from. And I thought it was just a thing I was going to call her. But now, of course, the children call her it, their teachers, everyone that knows us. So, yeah, I am in a certain amount of trouble for that one.
She's not pleased with that nickname?
No, I might have to come up with something better.
All right. Well, on a more serious note, the Speck, your older son, was diagnosed with autism. Your doctor told you at the time to put him in an institution and not have any more children, but you were already pregnant with your second child. So what did you think?
Well, that was, a devastating moment. And my son didn't speak till he was seven. So suddenly I was in a position where the one thing that I'm good at was of no use, and we had to find different ways of communicating. And it was really both sort of challenging and pretty amazing, actually, to discover the limitations of words as well as all the great things about them, and to find whole other ways of communicating with someone and trying to kind of find a way into their world. And yeah, he's really taught me a lot. He now does, the doctor said he would never speak, and he now talks nonstop. So I'm going to track that doctor down and sue him.
Yeah.
He won't shut up.
Wow.
I mean, just before I came on, I was arguing with him about whether he should wash his hair or not. And he said to me, "Don't derail the topic," as I was trying to justify why he should. So yes, he's now very good with words and has a wider vocabulary than me.
So did writing all of this down help with your anxiety and your depression?
I think what was really interesting is, I don't know if it's a comedy writer thing or a British thing, but you know, I'm pretty much consumed with self-loathing. So what was good about writing it down is, you know, I think when you're in the midst of the chaos of life, it's very easy to be hard on yourself, isn't it? And kind of think, I should be a better person or a better mother or a better partner or a better writer, whatever it is. But actually, when you write it all down and look with a bit more objectivity, I think, you know, you can sort of find a bit of compassion for yourself and think, oh, you know, I was doing the best I could with the kind of information and the resources I had. And it was quite a revelation to kind of realize that and to ease up on myself a bit.
Well, congratulations on the book, and thank you for the lovely conversation.
Oh, thank you. That was really fun. Thank you.
Georgia Pritchett's new book is called My Mess is a Bit of a Life, Adventures in Anxiety. Coming up, happy 100th anniversary to the Bat Mitzvah. The coming-of-age ceremony for Jewish girls first began in the United States in 1922 and paved the way for female rabbis 50 years later. We'll talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, 100 years ago this year, Jewish American girls earned the right to celebrate their entry into adulthood with the first bat mitzvah. Before, the coming-of-age ceremony was reserved for just 12 and 13-year-old Jewish boys, and that's called, of course, a bar mitzvah. It typically includes reading from the Torah in Hebrew before friends and family and signifies the young boy has become an adult. But in 1922, a rabbi in New York named Mordecai Kaplan decided he wanted a way to celebrate his daughter, Judith. And since then, nearly a million Jewish American girls have followed with their own bat mitzvahs. And a few decades later, the first female rabbi was ordained. Joining us to talk about the 100-year anniversary of the bat mitzvah in the United States is Rabbi Carol Balin, chair of the Jewish Women's Archive Board and professor emerita at Hebrew Union College in New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, take us back to 1922 and tell us about Rabbi Kaplan. Who was he and why did he decide that he was going to break with tradition?
So Rabbi Kaplan always said he had four reasons for introducing bat mitzvah to this country, the eldest of his four daughters being the first reason. So when his oldest daughter, Judith, turned 12, he said to her one day, "You know, Judith, I'd like you to become bat mitzvah." And she said, "Okay." And, you know, Rabbi Kaplan knew there had been some precedence for this in Europe, but really no kind of formal ritual in the way boys had been called to the Torah to become bar mitzvah. So he inaugurated the ceremony at his congregation. He had founded the synagogue just in January of 1922. And one of his first acts was actually to have his daughter become formally bat mitzvah during a worship service. And of course, 1922 is just 2 years after the passage of the suffrage amendment. And Mordechai Kaplan knew what was in the air, and he wanted to bring the best of American culture, politics, egalitarianism into Judaism.
So that's when women won the right to vote in this country. So was it just in the air that women's equality was in the air?
I think it was in the air. You know, he was a product of his time and of his era. He had these four daughters, no sons, and he wanted a way to correct girls' exclusion from Jewish education. So this way they would gain training like the boys. He did not, however, regard this in any way as identical to a bar mitzvah. A boy's bar mitzvah is a gateway. It's an entryway to consistent, regular participation in Jewish worship for the rest of their lives. For a girl, unfortunately, it was meant to be a dead end. She would have this ritual and the rite and the recognition, and then she would go back to her secondary status. But something unexpected happened along the way. More and more girls followed in Judith's footsteps. And over the course of several decades, the Jews in the pews, so to speak, became familiar, and it became normal in some ways to have female presence as part of Jewish communal worship. And unexpectedly, this brought about really a gender revolution in Jewish life.
In certain Jewish life, because in Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox communities, there's still a strict separation.
And you're right. I mean, still today in an ultra-Orthodox setting, a girl will mark her bat mitzvah, usually not, though, during worship service. Worship services, it will be outside of the typical Torah reading where men and women are present, maybe in front of a woman's prayer group. What I mean in particular is in the liberal movements of Judaism, it transformed not only these girls, but their mothers and their aunts and their cousins noticed, their grandmothers noticed these girls participating in Jewish life. And they said, "Hey, why not us?" And it really did spur on adult women to ask and sometimes in some respects demand to have more involvement in Jewish worship. And I argue by the time the first woman became a rabbi in this country, which is 1972, when Rabbi Sally Priesan became the first female rabbi, she really had girls of 12 and 13 to thank for normalizing female presence.
Interesting. But 1972, that wasn't so long ago.
Yes, so 50 years later. Yes. Yeah. I mean, none of these things are very long in terms of the long Jewish past. I mean, these are almost like the blink of an eye.
Exactly. When were you bat mitzvahed?
I became bat mitzvah in 1977. But what's really interesting in terms of my autobiography, I didn't realize it at the time, but in fifth grade, 2 years before I became a bat mitzvah, I dressed up for Purim, which is the holiday of costume revelers celebrating the biblical Esther's victory over the evil Haman. I dressed up as a bar mitzvah boy. And I think I did this, you know, in retrospect, because I thought boys were the real Jews, because they got all the privileges of Jewish life. And I didn't feel that I was entitled to or, you know, had that right. My older sister had just become bat mitzvah. But nonetheless, I didn't perceive that as the real thing, the real deal.
And yet here you are, a rabbi.
Exactly. And I thank those girls. If only I had known about Judith Kaplan and all the girls who had followed in her footsteps and really pushed for change.
And now what is it like in the various, I guess, denominations of Jewish religious life?
In the liberal movements of Judaism, conservative and reform, Reconstructionist, New Age, secular Judaism, it's identical to a boy. In the Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, as I said, it would take place outside of Shabbat worship, outside of Sabbath worship. Really, the next iteration moving forward in this gender revolution of coming of age among Jews is really the gender expansive kids who are really pushing us to the next iteration, the next stage. You know, those kids who don't feel like they want to become or should become a bar mitzvah, which means coming of age as a boy, of course, or a bat mitzvah, coming of age as a girl. They feel neither, they feel both, they feel agender. And so they're pushing us to the next stage, and they're creating ceremonies that are neutral in some respects. Non-binary kids are often calling their services a bi mitzvah, which, you know, taking the first letter, the bet in Hebrew. And bet in Hebrew, actually, it's wonderful. It means in, it means on, it means by. I think of it like a surfboard. You know, they're on the mitzvah, they're beside the mitzvah. They're sort of, you know, reinvigorating this kind of coming of age for kids who don't fit into these previously known categories.
That is fascinating. So would you say you are a bi mitzvah now?
Exactly. They call it bi mitzvah. Sometimes I'll say bi mitzvah, which would be more like the Hebrew pronunciation. There are other names that hasn't really crystallized exactly, but if you ask me, I think the bi mitzvah is going to win the day, which leaves it in the neutral space.
Well, thank you so much. That was a fascinating discussion.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad that this is a topic of interest, and we'll see where the next stage goes.
The next iteration of the mitzvah.
Exactly.
Carol Balin, Chair of the Jewish Women's Archive Board and Professor Emerita at Hebrew Union College in New York. And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.